David Morris is the most successful Australian aerial skier of all time and has won the silver medal in the 2014 Sochi Olympics and is also the author of Second Nature, The Making of a Professional Athlete. This is David Morris. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank.
With David Morris. David, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So you are an aerial freestyle skier, and I've seen some of these events where people are going off these ramps and doing ridiculous tricks.
And they seem ridiculous, I'm sure, yes.
they are for any average person, but I mean, how, and I've skied before, but I've never done anything like that. How did you even get involved in this in the first place?
Yeah, it's not a sort of a popular sport you come across every day, that's for sure. I was just very fortunate, and I was a gymnast growing up and also a skier. And I was just in my gymnastics club one day, and a former Olympian for the Aussie team in aerials happened to be in the gym that particular day watching me doing some flips. And I had a talk to her, and she just said, hey, we don't have any boys in Australia doing aerial skiing, would you be interested? And if you are, I'll happily coach you for free to get you started. And that was,
whoa.
So it was just super, by chance, the right person at the right moment who noticed what I was doing. And we just had a chat about it. And she sort of had enough connections and networking to introduce me to the right people. And I slowly made my way in. But most other people will get recruited by like scouts when they go to a gymnastics competition or something. But I just happened to meet the right person on the right day. Otherwise, would have never happened.
That's kind of an amazing story, because I mean,
it is very lucky.
I have like jokes with my friends, like I'm, you know, playing basketball or something like that. Like, oh, you know, what if, you know, someone saw me and, you know, recruited me, just as a joke.
And but it can happen.
Apparently, yeah. You must have been pretty good at gymnastics at that point, then.
No, I wouldn't say I was very good, to be honest. I was never, no, I mean, I could do some stuff, and I had, and it'll sound, you know, a little cocky, I had okay talent. I could adjust in the air. I knew where the ground was, but I wasn't high level gymnast by any means, because I just hadn't dedicated myself to that sport. Like, I enjoyed it, but I didn't really want to work hard, because I didn't see myself making the Olympics or anything big with that. So I was just doing it for fun. But when she said, oh, you know, aerials, I was like, oh, I've seen that on TV. That looks really good. So I went out and tried it, and then decided very, very quickly that that was going to be my chosen sport, and I was actually going to put time and effort and actually try, and worked out pretty well in the end. So she went on to her. She picked one boy in the whole country, and we were successful with that, and the rest of our team has been female.
Is that generally how athletes in the sport are developed? That seems like, you know, there's all kinds of like football and soccer. There's very, there's a farm system. But what about with aerial skiing?
In the whole country, we have 8 athletes. So it's quite tiny. We don't have facilities in Australia. They're actually getting built now, finally, after 100 years or whatever. Finally getting a water ramping facility. But we train overseas in the US. In Utah, there's this Olympic training facility there that we go and train into water off these plastic ramps in the summer. So you basically don't know about the sport in Australia unless you're found. It's not advertised. You don't really watch it on TV unless it's at the Olympics. So you get really 1 to 2 days of exposure to it, but no one really knows what it is.
Wow. I mean, it's like Hogwarts, you know, you get a letter in the mail.
That's right. Delivered by an owl. Just, oh, hey.
Yeah. You mentioned that you, when you're training, you use the water. You mean you go off a ramp and dive into a pool or something like that?
Pretty much. So they've got these big ramps, which are the same size as our jumps on snow, and they have specific angles and heights and measurements. So they're always very consistent. And on top of it, they've got this really hard plastic surface, which is, it's kind of like, oh, I don't even know how to describe it. Little bristles, like if you can imagine like a really thick broom or a brush with really hard plastic bristles that stick up, and your skis just slide over the top of those, and you wax your skis to protect them. But it's basically just, it feels similar to snow. you get the same speeds, and you go off the ramp, do your flips and land in the water and try and imitate the landing on snow position. Obviously, water is flat and the landing hill for our on snow is not flat, so you have to land a little bit leaning forwards in the water. So it basically feels like a big stomach drop into the water. And if you get winded, you did it properly. So it's a even training's pretty punishing, but it's a very interesting thing to watch if you've never seen it before.
Let's go back a second, because you spoke about how you made a commitment to this yes. sport and you wanted to take it seriously. About how old were you?
I was 19 when I was randomly recruited, which is quite old. Long story short, when I attempted to sort of go in and talk to Australia's like sporting organization about it, they just looked at me and said, "No, you're too old," like instantly. I wasn't tested or anything, so they just went, "No, you're too old, not good enough." And I was like, "Well, that's not very nice. So I'm just gonna keep training anyway. Not really gonna pay attention to you guys." But yeah, I mean, age.
What athletic body is?
It's just like Australian winter sports body. They okay. run the programs, and the programs are very heavily funded. Yeah. Like, we get a lot of government money, so they don't just like let random people turn up. So I kind of understand it. Yeah. But you know, with anyone, you should sort of maybe test them first. But they just went, "No, you're too old." And I was like, "Oh, I see." Mm. And then you go up and end up winning Olympic medals. So I was like, "Okay, well." But yeah, 19 when I started. So yeah, old, but not that old. My body wasn't old, because I hadn't been in this, like, hasn't been competing in sport for too long intensely. So the legs and everything were still in good nick. I was healthy. So it's really, it's just a number. Usually we will recruit people about 15 and sort of build them up, but then we have to train them to get strong and everything. So I was just there already. It was a bit of a strange one. I don't think they normally take people that age, but I had to fight my way in.
So let me, because I don't understand how people enter the sport here. You're saying that when you went to the Australian winter sports people, you were essentially asking for what? To get access to their training facilities, become
pretty much,
one
yeah.
of the team?
Yeah, so we could. There was a very small little jump site in Australia with like the smallest jump, and it's terrible. It's into a pond. It's disgusting. You know, there's leeches, and I don't know what sort of dangerous animals at the bottom of that thing. But yeah, you sort of go, and I was like, "Hey, I'd like to join the team and train with the team and make my way to, you know, hopefully an Olympics," because they have their proper structured team training program and proper coaches. The lady who recruited me was just sort of doing it, you know, by her own goodwill, just on the weekends. It wasn't going to be enough to help me be really good. So I was like, "Can I please join the actual team and just tag along?" And they just said no, like instantly. And I was like, "Ah, okay." I thought you might say yes, because you don't have any boys, but okay. And so it took me 2.5 years of going back and forth asking before they finally said yes. And in that time, I'd gone over to the US a couple of times to jump with the US team, who actually also even asked me if I wanted to join the US team, because they saw a decent amount of talent and said, "Oh, if you're interested, you could jump with our team." Obviously, I'm patriotic and I want to jump for Australia, but that would have also been an option. So yeah, 2.5 years of going back and forth asking if I could join the team and showing each time that I was getting better and better, and eventually they gave in and said, "All right, we'll give you a trial." And from then on, I was on the team as the only boy who'd been allowed to join the team in 15 years.
That a lot of people in that scenario, when they're told no, probably would have just been like, "Oh, well, all right then." And
pretty
then,
much, yeah. And that's a shame. When people want something and they think they're good at it, to just be told no is very off-putting. Luckily for myself, I'm very stubborn, and it's hard to explain to people. Like, I just sort of knew I'd be good at it, and I know that sounds really, it sounds really stupid to say out loud, but it's like if anyone, you know, goes to the gym, and if you've ever done box jumps, and you can put a box in front of someone and say, "Can you jump up onto this box?" and they can say yes. If someone says, "Oh, no, you can't," it doesn't mean they can't do it. Like, they know what they can do. They know their limits. Like, yes, right. I can do it. So when I saw this sport and I started training, I was like, I can do this, and I'm going to be good, because I just knew from my gymnastics background that this is something I could be good at. So when I was told no, it didn't discourage me. It annoyed me because it made it more difficult, but right. It didn't make me feel like, oh, I'm terrible. I was just like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep going until they say yes, because this is what I want to do. So that's good.
How did you make that determination at 19 that, okay, this is what I want to do? And did you know that you wanted to go to the Olympics at that point?
I'd always, as a kid, wanted to represent my country in a big event, whether it was Olympics or World Cup or Commonwealth Games, as we have for us Commonwealth countries. And I knew gymnastics wouldn't be it. And aerials, because it's such a sort of, it's a small sport, like the chances of making it are high if you're talented enough. Like there's not a big field to compete against. So there was a decent chance I could do it. And I was just like, I wanted to be remembered for doing something important. And I decided this was going to be it. And I was just going to dedicate myself. And if I didn't make it, that would be fine. But at least then I would know that I tried 100%. You know, no one actually really gives 100%. That's a lie. I tried as hard as I could.
Right.
And if I didn't make it, then I would know I gave it my best shot, but I wasn't going to let the opportunity slip away.
Do you think in some ways, because I've heard from other professional athletes, like I think of like Conor McGregor, who was mm-hmm. like a plumber at some point and was just like, yeah. I know I can do this.
I can do more.
Yeah. there's an element of ego to that, but yes. it's kind of, in some ways, do you think that sort of ego can be healthy, or do you think there are a lot of people out there who think, you know, oh, I can become an aerial skier who have put too much time into it and need to get.
Yes, I've seen that too. It is. And look, I'm fine to admit that there is some ego involved, and there is a very fine line between cocky and confident, and you can easily cross it depending on which side you want to be on. But you have to have a lot of self-confidence, and you have to project it as well. But I think if you're realistic with your expectations and realistic with what's happening around you, you can dance on that line very carefully. Like if stuff's not going well, and you can step back and be like, actually, you know what? I'm not that great. And don't lie to yourself about how amazing you are, just because like, but I want it so much. I work so hard. And I'm also a teacher and a coach, and I tell kids, I'm like, yeah, just because you work really hard and just because you want it more than everyone else doesn't mean you to win. Like right. Everyone out there wants it. Everyone worked hard. Everyone wants it more than you, but there's only one winner. And at the end of the day, if that's not you, that's okay. But you have to at some point go, yeah, I really want it. I really want to do it. But also step back and go, am I actually good enough? And there's a point where you can go yes, or be honest with yourself and say no.
You mentioned that you're the only male on the Australian aerial skiers. Is that ever like, I don't want to say like isolating, but do you ever feel
you can use isolating?
Okay.
it's challenging. It's very nice to have other boys around, because boys bounce off each other and compete against each other in a very healthy manner most of the time, to sort of push each other to get better. And it's just not quite the same with females. And that's a generalization. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but
right.
And in general, it's harder. It was harder for me to use my teammates to like, yeah, I'm going to beat you today. And it just wouldn't go over very well. Cause I'm like, oh, I'm going to beat you. And they're like, oh, well, we're not competing. I'm like, oh, but we are. I just wanted to be friendly. Make me work harder. It was challenging. It taught me a lot about how to handle female teammates. And it actually brought my ego down a little bit, which was also a healthy thing. So instead of being like super macho, I didn't feel the need to do that. So I just had to fit in with a bunch of girls and all work together. And it was interesting on its own, but it was a challenge, and it was a little bit lonely in that sense, because there was no one up at my level to keep me going. So I had to use people from other teams to motivate me. And because our sport is small, we are friends with everyone on every team. Like we know them quite well, and we'll go out and have a party afterwards, or we'll all go out to dinner. Like there's not a no vicious rivalry once you're off the hill. So I'd use other people up there to just be friends with and compete, you know, on a day-to-day against them. But it was a challenge, not gonna lie. It was difficult at times.
Was it ever the case that you made some sort of faux pas, or people or the rest of the girls on the team were like, oh my god, David, can you just calm down with your chauvinistic.
Most days, I'm sure. most days. I'm very competitive. I'm loud and I talk a lot. And sometimes they're like, "Can you please just stop?" And I was like, it took me a while to understand, like, what do you mean? You don't want to have fun and compete with me every day during training? It just took me a while to realize not everyone is like me. And they don't enjoy the competitive rivalry every second of the day like I do. And sometimes not talking is the best thing. I had to learn a lot, but that's just developing as an athlete too. And I didn't have any boys to shut me down. But I did have some other very high-level females on the team that also did teach me a lot of that stuff. And I looked up to them as role models, who had at the start doing harder skills than I was, and then eventually I overtook. But they were very good at guiding me through the whole process.
And do men and women compete together in aerial skiing?
No. Well, as of the next Olympics, yes, as a team event. But other than that, we're separate, like female event, male event. And generally, the guys do harder skills. So we do 3 flips with up to 4 or 5 twists. And the girls will generally do 2 flips, so they're 1 flip less, but they're now catching up. We've got a whole bunch of new talent coming up, and they're starting to do the same skills as the guys have been doing for many years. There's no reason that females can't do the same skills. It's just sort of been a thing that they haven't done them, but now they're taking a big step up in the sport, which is really good. But we all compete the same. Mm-hmm. The guys have just always increased a little bit more and done harder stuff, and now the girls are catching up. So there's no real difference in training as such.
And you made your debut in the Olympics in 2010, correct?
Yep.
In Vancouver. The perception that I have of the Olympics and athletes in the Olympics is that this is such a huge moment. I can't even imagine psychologically what that's like to prepare for it. When you're going into the Olympics and you've been training for years, is there any added stress factor just because of how big of a stage this is?
Yes, it would be silly to say there isn't. And of course we say like, oh, it's just another event, but it's not. We know it's not. We need to train like it is, and you're meant to behave like it is, like it's just another competition. You do the same skills against the same people. The competition format is what it is. You're used to it, but it's the Olympics. My first games, I've been to 3, so my first games was very overwhelming, and it was about taking it all in and understanding what the Olympics was. The second games for me was more business. I was like, I'm here to win. And then the third ones, I wanted to go and do a particular skill of incredibly high level, and I actually didn't really care about the result. I just wanted to max out my personal ability in the sport. So like each Olympics had a different focus for me, and I learned from each one to take into the next. But it is stressful. It is very overwhelming. But again, this will sound cocky, but as you do more of them, it becomes less of a big deal, and you just go out and do your thing.
I mean, I don't think that sounds cocky. It makes sense.
I try not to. It's like anything. Once you get used to it, it just is like, go and do what you've trained to do. But the first one's just like, oh God, I'm at the Olympics. All these people are so good. It's a huge event. Everyone's watching. And you have to just ignore that and go and do what you've trained. But it's easier to say that than do it.
What is life like in the Olympic Village? I've heard crazy stories that people are just hooking up with everybody.
They're probably all true. Yeah. There is a lot of that going on, I think, because everyone's in one place and you're sort of locked, you know, you're stored away in a village that no one else can get into. It is really cool being there because everyone you walk past is good at something. It's like, hey, you're probably world champ at this, you're good at this. Like, there's just elite people all around you. So you're not like amazing. You can walk down the street and be like, oh, I'm so good, but you walk past 10 people who just very well might be better than you. Very cool environment to be in. It feels professional, but it is also relaxed, and you can see that all these people who are really good are just people. They're in there all eating in the food hall. Everyone's just chatting away, having a great time. It's fun. It's different. It's interesting, but it's just a bunch of really good people hanging out in one place. It is cool.
You were talking about the competition aspect motivating you. Being around, do you try to, put yourself around people who are elite at, whatever they're doing? Do you think that helps in your training?
I think it does, because everyone approaches training and competitions differently. And some people are like super focused and they're just switched on. They can see just one goal. I'm completely the opposite of that. I'm very distracted. And I like being distracted because it helps me relax to then focus in at the last second and not waste energy. So everyone's different, but it's just you can learn something from everyone if you want. So you just watch and you go, oh, that's how that person reacts. Or is this person reacting well or badly? Do I want to copy this person or not copy that person? You take what you want from everyone around you and become a better version of all of them.
Now, you had gotten a hip injury. After the you say that it's not a pleasant memory.
No, it's not. It wasn't a good one. So I had the Olympics, and I actually only ever wanted to make the Olympics at just the first games. I never planned on doing any more than that, because being young and stupid, I guess, like 19, 20, I was like, I just want to go to the Olympics and get the uniform and have the Olympic uniform. And it was all about like getting the uniform and being an Olympian, which is, of course, nothing to be ashamed of. It is a big achievement, but that's actually not what it's about. And I just wanted the uniform. And then one of the girls on my team, Lydia Lassala, who's been Olympic champion, she's like, it's not about the uniform. It's about representing yourself and the country and competing well. And I didn't understand that until after. And so I competed in the first games and I came 13th, which was way above my ability level. But the top 12 make the finals. So I just missed out in the finals by one spot. And I came home and I was like, I'm Olympian, blah, blah, blah. I felt great. But everyone would always ask, how did you go? That's all people care about. How did you go? I was like, I just missed out in the finals. And they're like, And that was kind of it. No one cared that I was Olympian. They just cared about results and how you went. And so the year after the Olympics, I was like, I think I'm done. I've been to the Olympics. What's next? And my coach asked me to keep going because I was getting better and people would retire. So I came back and actually didn't really want to be there, because subconsciously I was like, I never really wanted to make one Olympics. I didn't really understand what the point of continuing was now that I was an Olympian. And then I got hurt that year because I wasn't really there competing and training properly. I wasn't focused. So I landed sideways and tore my labrum in my hip and just destroyed the whole joint. Did it twice, as a boy. When they hurt themselves, we're done. We're like, we're fine. We're good.
Right.
And then I kept training and did it again. I was like, okay, now I'm not fine. But it was not a fun experience. And it was a result of me not really wanting to be out there training properly. I was just kind of going through the motions. But that injury taught me a lot about myself and the sport, because going back through the rehab was such a stressful and annoying process, and having to learn to walk again properly and just do all these very basic things and do it so structured. And then when I got back, I was like, I do want to come back, because I just went through all that rehab. I didn't do that for no reason. So came back with a new fire to be better and not just go through the motions in training. I was there with a purpose. So it was the worst and best thing that ever happened.
It's interesting that you say that there were a lot of lessons in that, and the fact that you were ambivalent about even being there, how that led to an injury. And that there's kind of a bigger life lesson in that, that the distraction can, especially in such a high risk sport as yours.
It's an exaggerated version of real life. Because I went and talked to a bunch of swimmers once. And I was like, our sports are very different. If you guys are a bit tired or a bit lazy one day, you just, you swim slower. But if we don't pay attention, we end up in the hospital very quickly.
Right.
And you have to be focused. And it was a good life lesson. Like, when I'm doing something, be on task. Don't be distracted. Don't turn up and just do it because you have to. Like, do you want to be here today? Yes. Then you work. If you don't want to be there, why are you doing this? And it's a very extreme, but in extreme sport, that's what it is. And it was a good lesson. It was a life lesson to me to be in the moment, pay attention, do it properly.
I imagine with your recovery and being an Olympian, you had some pretty good resources and doctors around. What kinds of things were you doing for recovery?
It was a lot of muscle activation and control of the like glute muscles or leg muscles to stabilize the joint. I had our team physio call me, I think, like every night or every second night. And we'd go on Skype and she'd like, show me a little squats. And I could, you know, put a phone book on the ground and just step up onto that. And that was like the first stage of the rehab was stepping up onto a phone book. And that was hard, which is the worst. It was like proper muscle activation. And she kept me on task and made sure I didn't do anything stupid. Because of course, if you do something stupid, then you wreck it and you go back and you repeat the process. And so it was very, had to be super disciplined to go through rehab. Because if you mess it up, you do it twice. Or if you rush it, you do it twice. And that was a very good lesson to come back to the sport and start again at the basics and do it properly. The first time to get to my first Olympics, I had to rush and skip a lot of basic skills to do it because I actually managed to get there in 4 years, which is not really meant to be done that fast. But that came back and bit me later with the hip injury because I made a mistake that I hadn't trained properly for because I'd rushed the basics. So the rehab taught me to appreciate the process of getting to an end goal by doing it properly.
When you said you had made it to the Olympics in 4 years, do you mean 4 years after you first started training at aerial skiing?
Yep. So I started, basically started, and one of the conditions of me being allowed to be on the Aussie team as the boy was to make the Olympic finals in 4 years. So I started from scratch and make it there, which is not really possible. But I missed out by one spot, so it's pretty close. That took rushing, skipping basics, and just doing stuff I wasn't ready for, which worked out, but was always going to come back and get me.
You said that was one of the conditions for you joining the team was making the finals?
Yes. So they gave me just like goals each year to make it to a certain standard that I could make the finals at the Olympics. And if at any point I failed like these key performance indicators, I'd be kicked off. So like every half a year I had to pass these tests or skills or whatever to, you know, show that I was going to make the finals. So it was a
wow. But that's having not made the finals your first go around, were there any talks like, oh, you know, David, you got to get out of here? Or
no, because I did so well up until that point, and arguably during that competition, because it's a judge sport, actually should have been in the finals. And there was a lot of discussion about how bad the scores were. You know, that's what happens. That's our sport. But I basically should have made it. But after that competition and the media around it and being more exposed to the world, there was no getting rid of me after that. I was set on being on the team. But leading up to it was challenging.
And you came back for the 2014 Winter Olympics. And you won the silver medal.
Yep.
What? And I love you say it so casually.
It's another day, you know, whatever.
What is emotionally? Can you take me through that? At what point when you realize that you won? What is that feeling like that?
Obviously, it's impossible to really describe. Yeah. And the best way I say to it is like when people go through, you know, in Australia we have 12 years of school. I'm not sure what you have in the US. You know, you go through your main school and you get to the end and you get, you know, you have a result that gets you into university or whatever it is, the next step. So it's like you go through your whole schooling life, and at the end you get the result that you needed. That's what it feels like. That you work so hard for so many years, and there's all this pressure for this, you know, final year of exams or this last exam, and you're just waiting, and the result pops up, and you go, "That's what I was after," and it's that moment. It was honestly relieving, was probably the feeling that I had the most, because I was spending the whole career I was like jumping in spite of people who were doubting my abilities and telling me I wasn't good enough and I couldn't be on the team. So I was like jumping in spite of them. So to get a medal at the end was just a relief, because it was worth it, and that every moment of struggle and blah, blah was worth it. And it was interesting. So the competition itself was unbelievably stressful, very high level. And so I managed to get into the top four. So as the last round, top four guys jump off for the medals. And that was the most relaxing round of the whole competition for me.
Why is that?
I had one skill left that I was allowed to do because you can't repeat. So I just had one skill and everything had gone, you know, we had plan A, B, C, D, whatever to get to this event, get to last round. And it was going plan A. I was like, this is ridiculous. So last round, I knew what skill I was doing. I was going to go first. And in my mind, it was just like, well, I'm going to be at least fourth at an Olympic Games. That is awesome. If I do better, even more amazing. But I was like, I was so happy with being fourth that I went into that last jump. And I was like, if I don't make this, I'm still going to be fourth. So I went down with almost no pressure to do anything. I just did my jump. And it was same as my normal jumps, not amazing, just the same as my normal ones. I landed the same as any other day, and I got an average score. But the other guys in the top four were going for the gold medal. Like, they were there to win. And two of them messed up because they either missed their takeoff or just did something wrong, because it was just such a moment of, like, I have to do it right. And the moment they came off the jump, I knew they weren't going to land. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I've won a medal.
And it was, wow.
So I was like, oh, God, I've got a bronze medal. And then next guy crashed, and, I go, and now I've got a silver medal. And
yeah.
it was amazing. And I tried so hard not to, like, cheer as they crashed. Like, I had the biggest smile on my face. And then my friends, and I felt terrible for them because they deserved to get a better result. But I was like,
Right. Thanks
for that. I'm sorry you didn't, you know, land, but yes.
I'm so glad you say that, because you see that at any kind of awards, you know, people at the Oscars, you know, clapping when they lose.
Yeah.
And there's got to be something inside them going,
of course,
like, oh,
like that. You know, you got to be polite and you go, well done to the person. Obviously, you feel devastated if you don't do well. But also, this has to go both ways. Like, when you beat people, you have to also understand how they feel about it. And especially when these guys were better than me and they just messed up on the last jump because of the, you know, it's just that it takes one fraction of a second for them to mess up the whole thing. So I really felt bad for them. I was like, you know, you guys, I'm sorry that you didn't get your medals. You really deserved it. I'm happy with my position. No, I'll take my silver, obviously, but well done, everyone. So I tried to, you know, present myself as, yes, I understand where they're coming from, and that's all you can do. And, of course, everyone's saying, hey, well, great, well done. I was like, yes, I won a little bit. You know, I got the silver a little bit by default because you crashed, but at the same time, it's not my fault that you crashed.
Right.
Like, I did my job. So it was a bittersweet feeling as, you know, as a friend to the other guys, but personally I was like, oh, that was just, it was amazing.
And I imagine also, I've heard, you know, fighters talk about this, and you mentioned the difference between aerial skiing and swimming. The consequences are so high that, yeah, I imagine there's plenty of respect for people who fail or come up
absolutely
short in a competition like that.
Yeah, so that particular day, I was in the top four. I was the person with the least amount of, like, degree of difficulty in my skills. I had 3 flips and 4 twists, which sounds really big, but that's kind of the standard. And they were doing an extra twist. They're doing 3 flips and 5 twists, and all of them went for 5 twists because they wanted to win. That on its own was very highly respectable, and it just doesn't always pay off. So they gambled high, and unfortunately didn't do well. I just wasn't good enough to gamble higher, so I just did my normal and survived it. But that was the plan. So we planned, you know, plan A was to scrape through here and there and use this last skill as a good chance at doing well if some mistakes are made, and that's how it worked out. So, but I respect everyone who's out there. They're out there risking their life every day with us. We do it in crazy conditions. Everyone wants everyone to be safe. There's no, oh, I hope they crash and hurt themselves, because that's just not how it works. So it is disappointing when people don't get what they deserve.
You mentioned the pressure, obviously, that people feel before these jumps. Do you all meditate, or are there any, like, mental preparations that you go through?
We, like most people, have a sports psych that they work with. I had one that I didn't really use because, you know, at the start, it's like, I'm not crazy, I don't need a sports psych. you know, it's obviously not about that at all.
Right.
For me, I used her for, like, staying calm. Like, before you jump, have a routine, and the routine is the same. And it just puts you in a little moment where you go, oh, I've been here before, and I'm just going to now perform as normal. But, yeah, it's all, you know, I'd say 90% of the sports in the head, because the skill level itself is not challenging. You stand still, you move your arms, flap your arms around, you spin, but it's scary, which makes you make mistakes. You overthink, oh, I have to beat this person or get this score, and that creates mistakes. And so the less you can think and the more you can just do what you've trained, the easier it is. So we use calming techniques. And yes, some people for sure use meditation to calm themselves to go and perform as they've practiced, which is why in the last round I did really well, is because I didn't really care, which I say that very carefully, because I was like, fourth is awesome, anything better is also awesome, but I don't really care what the result is of this round because I'm already happy with myself. And so that was my moment of calm down.
Is there like an ideal body type for aerial skiers that you're going for, or what about your diet and things like that?
Oh God, if any nutritionists are listening, they're not going to like my diet. I'm very fortunate and I can eat whatever I want and stay the same weight and everything. Yet it doesn't help me with energy. So I had to end up eating more vegetables so that I could have more energy to perform, because I just get tired really fast, or I'd be dehydrated or something and I'd lose, I wouldn't be able to pay attention. And so I had to I saw a nutritionist about that. But body type wise, there's not a particular type that's better than any other. Most of the boys are sort of the same height. Body type, everyone has different body types. Generally, the boys are sort of the same height, but there's some people who are a bit taller and they look beautiful in the air because they have this nice long body line. Some people are a bit shorter and that's also fine. But it can be more challenging whether you're tall or small to achieve certain things. But it's about just coordination, strength, and confidence. But you could almost be whatever. I think obviously if you're too heavy, it creates a problem, because when you fall 15 meters out of the air and you're very heavy, it's pretty hard to land. But if you're too light, the wind throws you around. So there's somewhere in the middle.
There's a Goldilocks too.
There's a nice, there's that middle zone. Like I'm, 5'7". So not tall, but not small. It depends what your average is, but probably shorter than average. And I weigh 67 kilos, which, 142 or something. Times 2.2, 142 pounds or something like that. So
yeah, 147.
147 pounds. So relatively light, but not too light. But strength to body weight ratio is very high, and that's a key component. You want to be very strong, but not heavy.
I see. You mentioned doing, part of the pride of being an Olympian is representing your country. When you come back to Australia and you've got the silver medal, does your life dramatically change at all?
No, apparently. If it was a summer sport, yes. Because it's a winter sport and no one really knows what it is, it didn't do much at all. People sort of knew about it, and I was on the TV a little bit and getting interviews, but it didn't change much, other than that when I went back to coaching kids gymnastics, they suddenly listened to everything I was saying. Suddenly, they're like, oh, you must know what you're talking about. I'm like, I literally said the same stuff to you last year and you didn't do it, but now I know what I'm talking about. It does open a couple doors and gets you places, that's for sure. And you say, yes, I do this and here's what I achieved. And, it can get some good job opportunities, but it didn't change much. Like, I didn't get any sponsors from it.
Really?
No. Winter sports in Australia are just not big enough, especially aerials. And unfortunately, Olympic medal got me nothing. So it was just like, cool. And
what?
That's why I said so casually. I was like, yep, that's the Olympic medal. I was like, oh, would you like to sponsor me? And they're like, oh, sorry, aerials is a bit small. And I'm like, I was like, well, I have a medal. And it just, no one cared. So I just got on with it. So it was a little bit of a shame. But again, and that's why it depends on understanding what an Olympics is about. Because, the first time I was like, oh, I'm an Olympian. You want to be super famous. the second time I was there to get a result, and I got the result without the, oh, but I want to be famous because of it. And that comes a little bit with it, but it wasn't about that as much. I was happy with my result because that's what I'd trained for.
That's, was that at all, do you think that was a good thing in any ways that, like, you know, the idea of, oh, I'm, this is going to make me famous or something like that? In some ways, and you probably are much more aware of this than I am, that's probably can be a desire that corrupts people. And
I've watched that eat people up.
Really?
Absolutely. I've watched the want to win. The reason people wanted to win was because they would get sponsors and get all this money. I'm like, well, you're not here to win, then you're here for sponsorship. And that's not really what the medal represents. Like, an Olympic medal is, you know, it's the epitome of sporting events, like the best of the best on the day. And that needs to be the achievement, not, oh, I get money from it, or I want to be recognized. And that most of the time comes with it, but that I've watched that eat people, and when they didn't win the medal, it destroyed them because they were like, oh, but I had all these things planned. I'm like, you can't plan for something you don't have.
Wow.
Like, you don't, what a lot of people don't understand. And I got asked a lot of questions about, like, because it was silver, I'm like, oh, you just missed out on the gold. And I was like, no, you don't get it. I'd never had the gold in my pocket. I didn't lose the gold. I won the silver. It's very different thought process. Like, at the start of the day, no one's got anything. You have to go out and get it.
Right.
Each person you beat, you earn a position. So I earned a silver, and I'm like, oh, so close to the gold. I'm like, but the guy who got the gold earned the gold. I never earned it. And so it was never losing a position. So if people don't understand that, and that's the people like, oh, you know, I've got the gold medal, I'm going to get these sponsors. I'm like, but you haven't gone out and done a jump yet. You've got nothing. You're currently in last place.
Yeah.
So it's a very dangerous thought process.
Have you ever seen the opposite of people who have been rewarded with fame and sponsorships, and that's
yes, I've seen that too.
Soften them? Yeah.
Yeah, they like do well at a young age, and they get all these sponsors, and they just become like really cocky and just less of a they just become less nice, I guess. They're just so obsessed with themselves and how good they are. They forget about like how to work for things and how to appreciate what they're given. Some people just born amazing, and that's, and they find this thing they're good at, and that's, I mean, everyone's just jealous. Maybe it's just jealousy on my behalf. I'm like, oh, why couldn't I be that good?
Right.
But you can see it just sort of, it also can destroy people's personalities a little bit. Not everyone's, but many people it does. The fame gets to them.
What about these days? Do you hope to go to the 2022 Olympics?
Oh no, I'm done now. I'm finished. 2018 was my last ones, and I'm going into coaching.
Okay.
My body's given up. Well, it hasn't given up. I'm giving up before it gives up. I'm going to decide when I'm done.
Right.
Because like I said, you watch people who, one, either aren't talented enough and you're like, you should stop. And then there's other people who are so injured all the time, you're like, you should stop.
Yeah.
So I'm like, can feel it starting to deteriorate. And so instead of pushing that limit, I was like, yeah, I achieved what I wanted. I got everything I wanted out of the sport. And you know, Olympic medal's great. Winning would have been nice, but still got, for myself, everything I wanted. I'm like, and I can happily walk away feeling like I've achieved something and made an impact. But yeah, I need to be smart, because if you push it too long, that's not clever. And there's so many up and coming young kids. I'm like, oh my God, if one of these 16-year-olds beats me, it's going to ruin me. I can't take that.
So yeah.
it's your generation, next generation coming through. I can't let this young gun beat me. It'd be so demoralizing.
I watched an interview with the world chess champion Magnus Carlsen, and he had just won his title again against a 16-year-old. And they're like, how's it feel? He's like, yeah, you know, it would have felt pretty bad to lose to a 16-year-old.
Yeah, so. But I mean, if they're better, they're better. But yes, it's, and that's where the ego's still there. You want to be the best, but if you're beaten by someone who you think you should beat, it's not super fun. But you have to deal with that as well.
Is there any way for people to get into the sport casually? I know you're trying to popularize it.
We're getting a proper facility built in Brisbane, which is another city that, you know, no one's heard of. And so we'll have a proper ramping facility like they have in the US and other countries. That will make it easier to get in because people can come and watch, get exposed to it. You can come and do like, hey, come and do a trial without having to travel overseas for months just to see if you're good. You can take a, you know, a drive up to this place, try it out, see what you think. And we'll have a bigger pool of athletes to pick from and therefore hopefully popularize it a lot more like it is here. It's like in the US, it's pretty easy to, it's easy to be exposed to it because you can literally come and try it. Like anyone turn up, come and try. And if they're good, coach goes, have you considered maybe doing a proper camp?
Yeah.
Yes, hopefully that will help.
Before we wrap up here, is there any way that people can find you online? I know you have like a YouTube channel and you got your website, right?
I've got like at Aerial Skier is my tag. I don't know how I got that. Managed to get onto that early. Lucky me. Yes, I've got like Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. I just have like David Morris Aerial Skier. And I try and put up either entertaining videos, nice pictures, or educational videos where it's like, you know, here's how to learn how to flip safely on trampoline. Because I see all these terrible videos online about self-taught people teaching everyone else how to do flips. I'm like, you will kill someone. Like, please, if you are not an expert or you're not trained to do this, don't teach people how to do stuff. It's just so bad.
Yeah.
So I try and better educational videos. I'm like, here's how to safely learn a nice back tuck on. Here's how to do twists, blah, blah, blah. So that's a nice little side project for me. But I try to keep people entertained as much as possible because now that I'm, you know, stopping jumping, I don't have cool clips anymore. A bit disappointing.
Well, you certainly have entertained me and I'm sure everyone listening. David, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thanks for interviewing me. I appreciate it.
Thank you to David Morris, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.